Okay. I want to thank the Adult Ed Committee for putting together this evening's program. I want to thank Dr. Eric and Tammy Teller for spearheading this part of the program. And of course, I'm very grateful to Rabbi Dr. Ari Lam for accepting to speak to us this evening about the contribution of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lam, and then next Sunday evening to speak to us again about the contributions of Lord Rabbi Sacks. We are very fortunate in that the Lam family has come to join our community, and that we have the blessings of the gifts of my Dr. Ari Lam. My Dr. Ari Lam was a Fulbright scholar during part of his training, and completed his doctorate at Princeton in Near East Studies and in Comparative Religions. And all of this was after completing smicha at our yeshiva. His main focus at this part of his life is to explain how many of the biblical themes and teachings can have an impact on the thinking of Western civilization and the thinking of the American people. And as such, he has a podcast series that speaks to that and has begun a project. The Project Joshua is part of his leadership to the B'nai Zion organization, which seeks to create bridges and allies between the Jewish people and like-minded people of other religions. But most of all, Dr. Ari Lam brings to us the scholarship, the erudition, the charisma, and the gifted ability to present that we will enjoy this evening and again next Sunday night. And I thank you very, very much for teaching us tonight and next week.
Many thanks, Tarmor Da'asra, for the very kind introduction. We are enormously fortunate to have such a leader who so embodies Torah Vavod of Gmilas Chassadim over the course of this exceptionally difficult year. And I think it almost goes without saying, but it needs to be said nevertheless, that that Ashreinu, that we have a shul with such leadership and such wisdom at its head. So I'm really pleased to be here with all of you, fellow members of the community, this evening, and I am even more honored to have the opportunity to speak about somebody very important to me, to all of us, to our community, and to the wider society. I'm going to quickly share my screen. Are people able to see this? Okay, good. By way of introduction, I suppose I'll relate a story that occurred before I was born, but nevertheless, it has gained some notoriety within the family, and I think it's an appropriate way to open the evening, and that is when my grandfather, Mori Zakeni, Rabbi Norman Lam, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, assumed the helm of Yeshiva University, one of his earliest responsibilities and privileges was to decide upon a recipient of the honorary doctorate that Yeshiva University would bestow upon somebody who was worthy. This was, for those of you who follow along with Yeshiva University's history, you will note that, of course, this took place at a time in the history of Yeshiva University when the institution seemed not long for this world. And so, of course, our great fortune was that it persevered and it thrived and it flourished. But at the time, there seemed to be a lot riding on this choice of honorary doctorate, because every decision that brought public attention to Yeshiva University was something that could impact the very future of its viability. And so my grandfather felt that there was a great amount at stake. One of the early, I may have even been the first, one of the early recipients of Yeshiva University's honorary doctorate in his tenure was the president of Israel. The president of Israel at the time, Yitzhak Shamir. I believe he was the president at the time, or he was shortly to become the prime minister in a trade-off with Shimon Peres that never actually occurred. Myself was Simon Labanim. But in any event, Yitzhak Shamir accepted the honor from Yeshiva University, and he was scheduled to come to Washington Heights, to Lamport Auditorium, to receive the honor. Now, in order to understand what happens next, you need to understand a little bit about my family. In my family, my great-grandfather, my grandfather's father, whom we knew as Zaida Sam, my grandfather's father, was very proud of him. Detested rabbis in general, but was very proud of his two sons who became quite prominent rabbis, was a dead ringer for Yitzhak Shamir. If you knew anything about my Zaida Sam, is that he looked identical to Yitzhak Shamir. You couldn't distinguish them in a lineup, that's for sure. And so when Yitzhak Shamir came to Yeshiva University, as was natural, the university invited all of the prominent Jews from across the country, the glitterati of the Jewish world at the time, and even among the non-Jewish world. I mean, he was an important personage. And so those who were well-connected or aspired to be such in the political world wanted to attend. And so, the entire Jewish world converged on Lamport Auditorium for this occasion. My grandfather, of course, wanted his parents to be front and center when he took the stage for one of his early public events as president of Yeshiva University. So he reserved at the front of Lamport Auditorium a space for his parents to sit. My grandfather arrived at Lamport Auditorium that morning and, to greet Yitzhak Shamir when he would eventually come. And as he gets there, he sees a crowd of very important people congregating near the front of the auditorium. And he sees that they're all surrounding his father, my Zaida Sam. And I mean, politicians and millionaires and very important people are all pestering him with questions. My grandfather immediately understood what was going on. So he rushes to the front, extricates his father from the scrum, and he says, "What's going on?" And my Zaida Sam says to his son, Rabbi Lamb, "I think they thought that I was Shamir." And my grandfather says to him, "Well, then why don't you correct them?" And he says, "Well, they asked me what I thought about the situation in Lebanon, and I had opinions about Lebanon, so I told them what I thought." And, to me, this is not only a classic story about my grandfather, but it really is an encapsulation, I think, of the Jewish story, which is that we all have lots of opinions about everything, and we're always ready to share them. And so it strikes me that in appreciating my grandfather's contributions to the Masorah, which reflects the wonderful title that the shul gave to this talk. It seems to me quite appropriate, we could spend untold lifetimes plumbing the depths of my grandfather's Torah, but I'd like to focus on one particular element of his oeuvre, of his contributions to the world of Jewish thought. And that is in particular, the way in which he believed, or sort of the unusual and I think extraordinary way in which he believed that we, the Jewish people, should make our opinions known to the wider society. And I say unusual, not in the sense that they diverged in any way from classical Jewish thought. On the contrary, they, I think, were the highest expression of the Masorah. But they were unusual given the historical circumstances that surrounded them. And that's really what I want to call attention to this evening. So I want to frame my grandfather's spiritual and intellectual career in this regard by reference to a space mission. The year was 1968. In fact, it was almost exactly 52 years ago this past week, that the Apollo 8 space mission successfully orbited the moon. It was the first time that humans had done such a thing. And it was also just a couple of days before my grandfather's birthday, which was the December 19th, 1927. He was born December 19th, 1927. Just a couple of days later, the Apollo 8 space mission orbited the moon and broadcast their successful orbit back to the rest of the huddled masses of humanity gathered back on planet Earth. And they did so on Christmas Eve of 1968, which was December 24th. And at that moment, now you can just imagine for yourselves for a moment what that moment would look like today in 2020. I mean, this was an extraordinary, enormous, unbelievable, unprecedented leap forward, to borrow a phrase from a later space mission, a leap forward in humanity's technological prowess, its ability to subdue nature and its forces and to plumb the magnificent depths of creation. And at a moment like that, you can imagine, as we all can from looking around at some of those who are at the forefront of technology in our own day, that this would be a moment for humanity to engage, maybe understandably, but still not desirably, in a bit of kochi ve'otzem yadi asa sachay alazeh. This would have been a moment for humanity to say, look at how amazing we are and how accomplished we are and how mighty we are. And in fact, what actually happened on December 24th, 1968, was the following.
It's now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on the
I don't know if the audio was exceedingly clear, but just to recap for you, what happened on December 24th, 1968, was that the three astronauts in the Apollo 8 space mission chose, as the words that they would send, the first words that they would send back to planet Earth as they orbited the moon, was they read the opening, the King James translation of the opening verses of Sefer Bereishis. That was it. No commentary, no embellishments. They simply read the words of the living God. It was in this moment, or at this moment in time, that Rabbi Norman Lamb had just come into his prime as a thinker. It was just a couple of days short of his 41st birthday, really when he was emerging as a primary voice in the Orthodox Jewish community, in the wider Jewish community. And it's critical to grasp this because I think it gives you a sense of the possibility that my grandfather understood had appeared before him and before all of the Jewish people at this moment in time in an unprecedented manner. And that was, this was truly the first moment in recorded human history when we could truly recite the words of these psukim and mean them. Hashamayim misaprim kvod kel umase yadav magid harakia. This was a moment when we could truly hear the heavens speaking to us. Now consider, for thousands of years, the Jewish people, and we do this ad hayom hazeh, for thousands of years, the Jewish people had said to each other, had said to themselves, that the wisdom that we bequeath to the world, the holy words of Torasenu HaKadosha, is essential wisdom for humanity to find its way in this world. But how many people listen to us? I mean, Avraham Avinu was born into a world that had been mired in idolatry for thousands of years. It would be another 1,000 years before even the Jewish people stamped out paganism, let alone the rest of the world. I mean, this was a world in which the words of the Torah were not often heard, or at least not heard clearly by humanity. But finally, we were at a moment when the most powerful nation on earth, the most accomplished country, and the most accomplished nation in modern history, perhaps in recorded human history, had, and which was rooted, as the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote many, many times in the 1960s, was rooted in the values and the ideas of the Hebrew Bible, of the Torah, actually accomplished something unthinkable. And when it did so, it explained its accomplishments by reference to the Torah. In such a moment in history, my grandfather believed, and my grandfather lived this conviction over the course of his career. At such a moment, our responsibility as a people changes, or at least it develops. Whereas prior to this epoch, our responsibility was merely to survive, or at least that was in many ways the best we could hope for. We could survive. We could develop our own traditions internally. And of course, for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, great Jewish thinkers and sages did the engaged in the incredible, spiritually edifying and ennobling work of developing the tradition of the Torah. But now our mission was shifting from preserving an internal development to taking all of that wisdom and bringing it out to the wider world so that the wider world could learn from us. Literally, Kimitzion Teitzei Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. This was the first time in human history where this could literally be possible. And in such an era, my grandfather believed it was essential. Rabbi Lamb believed that it was essential for Judaism to develop a plan or a method for how to communicate its ideas to the wider world and how to engage the wider world in such a way that our Masorah, the Masorah of which we are stewards, could best inform the world around us and elevate it so that we could truly fulfill the words of the Navi, Ki Besi Beis Tefila Yikar El Chol Ha'am. And my grandfather's approach in this matter consisted of three pillars. The first pillar was that we, the Jewish people, if we were to serve as the ambassadors for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah and godly values that we were always meant to be, we needed first and foremost a willingness to listen. And in order to explain what I mean by this, I'll refer you to, or I'll relate to you just an anecdote, a personal anecdote, but one that I think is one that I think exemplifies the way that my grandfather thought about wisdom. My grandfather truly, truly believes that if we are going to impact the society around us, if we're going to influence the rest of the world for the good, such that by Yom Ahu Yeh Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad, we need to have open ears. It can't just be a one-way street, in much the same way that you can't influence people and make friends simply by screaming, by yelling, by talking at people. You need to actually talk with people. So too, if we, the Jewish people, were going to influence the world for the better, we needed to be able to listen first. It was the first thing we needed to be able to do. And my grandfather didn't just believe this in sort of the realm of Jewish to non-Jewish communication. He believed this was essential within the world of Torah first and foremost. So when I was, when I was younger, already in high school, but also shortly after high school, when I finally grew up enough and matured enough to appreciate the treasure that I had in having a grandfather like the one that I had, I began to learn on a regular basis with my grandfather, Bechavrusa. And one of the things that he insisted on learning, in the early days were Hakdamos, the famous Svarim, and some not so famous Svarim. My grandfather insisted that we learn Hakdamos. Why? He was convinced that it was only in the introductions to great Svarim that you get the real Hashkafa of the authors. And so we would go through, we went through numerous great works of Torah and read the introductions. Now, if I asked you, what would you assume would be the first introduction that we would read? So you might think, if you want to pigeonhole my grandfather, maybe we read the introduction to something by Rav Hirsch, something by Rav Kook, something by one of the paradigms of what you might later call a Torah Umada. No. Oh, well, you might think we would pick one of the classics, right? We would pick the Hakdama to the Chasam Sofer, the Hakdama to the Netziv's commentary in the Torah, all things that we did, by the way. Hakdama to the Eger's Moshe, to Rabbi Akiva Eger. Nope, none of those. The first Hakdama that we learned together was the Hakdama to the Vayol Moshe by the Satmar Rebbe. Now, the Vayol Moshe is the locus classicus. It is the ground zero for anti-Zionism. And I will never forget. I still have my notes here in one of my files. Still have my notes of the photocopy that my grandfather gave me of the Hakdama to the Vayol Moshe with handwritten notes on them. And I remember jotting down a thought at the time that as we were reading through this Hakdama, and the Satmar Rebbe describes the villainy that he saw at the root of all modern evils that have afflicted the Jewish people, from the Holocaust to secularism to what have you. Everything that the Satmar Rebbe thought was wrong with Judaism and was sinful about those who were perpetrating it, in essence, not all of it, but much of it, described my grandfather. And I remember thinking to myself as we were learning, there is no way that he can't know that this is about him. And as we learn, and he never mentioned a word about this, he just thought it was important to learn Vayol. He thought it was very important to learn Vayol Moshe. In fact, he wrote articles about Vayol Moshe. But I remember thinking to myself at the time that this really captured the essence of, or part of the essence of my grandfather. He truly believed that it was critical to learn from those with whom you disagree, and not just in a Maimonidean sense, in the Rambam sense of Kabbalah Samas Mimisha Amar. You have to accept the truth wherever you find it. It wasn't just that. It wasn't just you look for the truth and wherever it is, you find it. He really thought that there was something important to finding those with whom you fundamentally disagree and seeing if there is any truth to be found in their words. Because if there is, it's those truths that you are least likely to find, and therefore that you are least likely to ever encounter. So my grandfather felt it was critical to listen to those with whom he disagreed. And in fact, as I was preparing this shiur, this was brought home to me in a very personal way. As a preface, if I get through this shiur without crying, it's going to be a miracle. So just as a warning, I was looking through. My grandfather had a wonderful and voluminous library, as you can imagine, and we, his children and his grandchildren, were very fortunate to be able to receive many of his svarim to keep it and learn in our own homes while he was alive and after he was nifter. One of the svarim that he that I was fortunate to get from him, I'm just looking at it, it's on my shelf right here, was his copy of the Nefesh HaChaim, which is very important to him because, as some of you may know, the Nefesh HaChaim and the works of Rav Chaim Volozhin more generally were the subject of his doctoral dissertation, which he did with the Rav Zatzal. This is, I don't know how widely known this is, but he's the only person to have received his smicha and his PhD from the Rav. But I think I've heard it phrased that way sometimes, but it's sort of cheating a little bit because he was also the only person to get a PhD from the Rav Zatzal. So you could really just phrase it that way. But the Rav, he did his doctorate on Rav Chaim Volozhiner with the Rav. And so his copy of the Nefesh HaChaim was naturally something that I very much wanted to be able to have and to be able to learn from. Like many of the Svarim that my grandfather had on his shelves, they were prodigiously marked up and annotated. And I always find it fascinating to look at passages that he himself thought were important. And this one from the back of the Nefesh HaChaim, where there are a collection of stories related about Rav Chaim Volozhiner, There is one particular story about Rav Chaim, Kuf Ayin Bet, which I've shown you in his, this is his copy of Nefesh HaChaim, and this was a sticky note that he put there himself. This was a story that resonated with him. It was one of the few stories in the back that he personally footnoted. And I thought it spoke to this willingness to listen. It was a story told about Rav Chaim Volozhiner that there was a certain person in his community whom the Sefer here refers to as a balabas. And for those of you who are familiar with Lithuanian rabbinic culture, you will know that there is no more heinous insult than to call someone a balabas. There's a balabas in Rav Chaim's community who had learned Shas a couple of times, although the way that the story puts it, it was Shekvar Chazar Kol HaShas Kam upon him. He'd reviewed Shas several times. V'hu Baki Kim'at Bo, and he was sort of an expert in it. So there's already some disdain in the text itself. But he was a balabas. He didn't really know Shas that well. He hadn't learned it the way that the guys in the yeshiva had. So he was Stam balabas. He did dafyomi. And every time he walked into a room, Rav Chaim would stand up. Rav Chaim Volozhiner. And when his students asked him, why would you stand up for such a relatively unaccomplished person? Rav Chaim apparently responded by saying, you know, there are two versions of the Talmud that we're all familiar with. Now, we today are familiar with the Vilna Shas, the Vilna printing of the Shas. But in Volozhin, apparently, there were two versions that they used. One was the Amsterdam Shas. The Amsterdam printing of the Shas was a very nice printing of the Shas. And it was apparently free of errors, or it was relatively free of errors. And it was the one that was standard use amongst the Bnei HaYeshiva. And then there was the Zaltzbach Shas. The Zaltzbach Shas, which was done in the 1700s, was a notoriously mistake-ridden printing. It wasn't very nice, and it was in some cases a misleading printing of the Shas, but it was nevertheless, you know, a copy of the Shas. And Rav Chaim said, look, some people are Amsterdam Shasses. And it's wonder if you're an Amsterdam Shas, if you are a Baki B'Torah and you've really learned the Torah B'Am Kuso, then fantastic. But there are other people who are Zaltzbach Shasses, and they may have some mistakes, and they may have some errors. Some of the things that they say may be misleading, and they may not fit the mold of what we consider to be a person perfectly suitable for us to follow them. But nevertheless, a Zaltzbach Shas has Kedusha. And it is incumbent upon each and every one of us to recognize that even the Zaltzbach Shasses in our lives are worthy of our respect. And, you know, of course, I don't think my grandfather considered the Satmar Rebbe a Zaltzbach Shas. The Satmar Rebbe was a Gaon Nifla, even if my grandfather believed that he was deeply and sorely mistaken about many things. But nevertheless, I think it bespeaks the fact that my grandfather was attracted to this passage, I think speaks volumes about the kind of person that he was and the way in which he thought it was important to listen to people, not just Amsterdam Shasses, but Zaltzbach Shasses. And this willingness to listen, I think very famously, sort of typified my grandfather's approach to Torah in general, especially his approach to Torah that became famous from later in his career. And we'll return to some of the stuff that developed earlier in his career in a moment, but I think it's important to acknowledge that the development in the Torah world that for which my grandfather was best known in the popular imagination was Torah Umada, which in essence represents a willingness to listen and to hear the wisdom that emanates from the entire world around us. I don't think that I could do, any better in this respect, explaining this willingness to listen than letting my grandfather speak for himself. So I'll give you a listen.
The broader my intellectual horizons, the higher is my spiritual reach and the deeper is my religious commitment. The more comprehensive and inclusive the domain I conceive to be that of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the closer do I approach that ever receding asymptotic ideal of Shlemus. This is Shlemus with a wide angle lens instead of a zoom lens. And this indeed is a hint of what Torah Amada can mean to us if it is structured on the basic Hasidic ideal of Avodah B'Gashmias. Grasp grasping a differential equation or a concept of quantum mechanics can let us perceive and reveal Elokus in the abstract governance of the universe, an insight into molecular biology or depth psychology or the dynamics of society can inspire us with a fascination with God's creation, a fascination which the Rambam identifies as Ahavas Hashem. A new appreciation of a Beethoven symphony or a Cezanne painting or the poetry of a Milton can move us to greater sensitivity to the infinite possibility of the creative imagination with which the Creator endowed his Tzelem Elokim.
B'mechilas kvo Toras Mori Zakeni, I would never cut my grandfather off that way, but just in the interest of time, we really should just listen to that entire clip. But you can get a sense of my grandfather's incredible willingness to listen. He could hear the holiness of our Creator in music, in art, in chemistry, in literature, and especially in an age where the wider world was so ready to listen to us and to the wisdom that we've bequeathed to the world. It was imperative that we be willing to listen as well, for otherwise, how could we teach? However, I'd put it this way, and I use this word with some trepidation because my grandfather, in one of his sermons for Yom Kippur, it's one of my favorites, he has a line where he says the word but, and he's referring to the word aval. The word but as a moral loophole has no business in the language of Jewish life. So with that in mind, I do say aval, but my grandfather's willingness to listen was, I think, sometimes, even during his lifetime, and this caused him no end of pain, and he objected to it publicly many, many times. My grandfather's willingness to listen was, I think often cheapened, if not bastardized, into what I would call in halachic parlance, a matir, a permission slip to be less than punctilious in your observance, and not just less than punctilious in your observance, but comfortable, more comfortable than our brethren in other parts of the community for lack of a better term, I would call the secular world. And my grandfather thought that this was rank nonsense, and he said as much in Torah Ramada. So I fortunately, when I opened my own copy of Torah Ramada, these passages were already underlined. As my grandfather said, this is not merely, well, and I should back up. You heard in that video, my grandfather endorsed the Hasidic model for Torah Umada, which was Avoda Begashmias, the way of worshiping Hashem through physical acts, whether it be chopping wood or eating a hearty meal. As my grandfather argued in Torah Umada, he thought it was really not much, not even a step at all from worshiping God through physical activity to worshiping God through intellectual activity. And my grandfather, although he lays out in the book Torah Umada, I think seven different models or six different models for how Torah Umada could proceed, each one of which he distinguished from the others, he actually did have a preferred one, which he says explicitly in the book, which was the Hasidic model. And when he describes the Hasidic model, he says, this is not merely a dispensation for Torah Umada. It is a divine imperative, a charge to seek inspiration in the broadest realms of the intellect and imagination. Just as Hasidism succeeded in expanding the realm of the sacred to cover the profane, and here's the key quote, my grandfather believed that Torah Umada was the very opposite notion from contemporary secularism, which is antagonistic to the encroachment by the sacred on the public domain and seeks to restrict the sacred. My grandfather believed that our willingness to listen should not create in us a willingness or a readiness, let alone an enthusiasm, to embrace the tenets of the secular world around us. On the contrary, it should cause us to become warriors in the fight against encroaching secularism. We merely should do it in a more holistic way. And I think the reason this is, before I open that up, the reason this is not for out of any reasons of convenience or a failure of nerve on my grandfather's part, chas v'shalom. It was because the very notion of Torah Umada that he championed, Avoda Begashmias, the idea of being able to hear God, as it were, or see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it were, in everything that he has created in this world, to find the holy sparks of divinity amongst the klipos of creation, was at the very heart of what he believed Torah Umada was. As my grandfather said, when one is involved in any worldly matter, he has it in his power, by virtue of his thoughts and intentions, to liberate those sparks, returning them to their divine source. This act of the redemption or elevation of the divine sparks is in and of itself an act of the greatest religious significance, not merely an instrument for some later fulfillment. So my grandfather believed that sanctifying profane activity, whether that be physical activity or intellectual activity, was not merely a function of our willingness to listen. It was also a function of what I would call our willingness to teach. That the Jewish people actually have to be able to change the world, not just listen to it and accept it as it is. We have to be willing to change the world. And that, I think, ties Torah Umada much more tightly to a lot of what my grandfather taught much earlier in his career and continued to teach throughout the rest of his career. People are often surprised to note that the words Torah Umada do not appear ever, once, even a single time, in any of the drushas that he delivered earlier in his career as a pulpit rabbi. Not because he didn't believe in it, chas v'shalom. It suffused his entire character. But because my grandfather focused, especially earlier in his career, and continued to focus throughout the rest of his career, on the Jewish obligation to teach. Now, when my grandfather thought about the obligation that the Jewish people have, not merely to listen to the rest of the world's wisdom, but to impart our own wisdom to the rest of the world, my grandfather thought about this in three ways. First of all, my grandfather wanted to know, why do we have an obligation to teach the rest of the world? Right? Why do we have to go out and teach the world? Maybe Torah, maybe our wisdom is just for us, as long as we have a nice kiddush at the end of Shabbos, at the end of Shul, maybe we should be happy. Our community is thriving, and while the rest of the world is falling apart, maybe we shouldn't care about the rest of the world. My grandfather thought that that was crazy and in many ways immoral. We have an obligation to teach and to show the world and to show the rest of the society a world not just as it is, but as it ought to be. And we needed to use the Torah to do that. So why do we have to teach? Well, in a sermon from 1964 on Parshas Korach, which was called Rebel and Revolutionary, my grandfather explored the question of whether or not there is any room for rebelliousness or for a revolutionary character in Yahadus. After all, Korach is sort of the arch-revolutionary of the Jewish tradition, is roundly and soundly condemned for being such. And so you might think that Judaism has no ethic of rebellion or no ethic of revolution. And my grandfather thought that that was wrong. And over the course of this sermon, he explored corrosive and toxic forms of rebellion, the kind which Korach exemplified, and holy forms of rebellion. My grandfather wrote, what is the prophetic tradition, if not the expression of a revolutionary character? It had its genesis in Abraham, who was an iconoclast. It reached heights in Moses, who defied Pharaoh and both the military might and cultural hegemony of Egypt. Elijah was a revolutionary when he challenged Ahab, and Isaiah when he thundered against the drunkards who ruled the northern kingdom of Israel, and Ezekiel when he dissented from the popular worship of Bel and Marduk. For 3,500 years, Judaism has been out of step with the world and has thus managed to be its repository of sanity and sanctity. It's one of my favorite lines in his drushas. The reason that we have an obligation to teach, the reason that we have an obligation to borrow a phrase from William F. Buckley, stand against the culture, stand athwart the culture yelling stop, the reason why we have an obligation to stand against the rest of the world when we believe that they are making grievous errors, and not merely stand against them by being different ourselves, but stand against by actually raising the alarm, is because that is the nature of what it means to be a chosen people. We have always been rebels. And in fact, my grandfather was not the only person to realize this. In the history of America, this is, in the words of John Adams, our second president, the Jews have given more and more happily than any other people, ancient or modern, to mankind, and have spread religion to 3/4 of the globe. The Jewish people have always played this role. we have always been the ones to teach the rest of the world when they've gone wrong and encourage them when they go right. Now, question number two is, what do we have an obligation to teach? And here, I think it's the answer is really our obligation is to teach them ever is to teach the rest of the world everything. But if I could focus on one area of thought that was particularly important to my grandfather, and that I think our community has a very unfortunate tendency to, and in which our community has a very unfortunate tendency to dismiss spiritual and rabbinic insight, is politics. And here, my grandfather, you know, there is this, I think there's this widespread sense, particularly in the American Jewish community. You find it in the modern Orthodox, for lack of a better term. You find it in our community. You find it to our right. You find it to our left. There is the sense that religion and politics should not mix. Rabbis should never talk politics. My grandfather thought that this was morally reprehensible. Morally reprehensible. And in fact, he thought this as early in his rabbinic career as you could possibly imagine. In a sermon from December 6th, 1952, again, my grandfather delivered some of his best sermons right around his birthday. And a sermon from December 6th, 1952, just shy of his 25th birthday, mind you. My grandfather delivered the following sermon about the Korean War talks. He said, now it is not the business of a rabbi to comment on purely political or diplomatic matters. Rabbis shouldn't be partisan, he believed. However, but when matters of principle are involved, then the people have the right to know what the teachers of religion have to say about the burning issues of our time. When the propaganda machines have ceased their loud clattering and the din of the partisan shouting has been silenced, the still small voice of religion must make known its moral and spiritual judgment. Rabbis, thought my grandfather, should not be partisan, but certainly they should comment on politics, because if we restrict religion and the insight of Torah only to those realms of our life which are so insignificant that we don't care if our rabbis talk about them, then we're not taking religion seriously. And lest you think, by the way, that my grandfather in the course of this sermon merely, you know, laid out the issues and gave you a conceptual approach to thinking about it, but didn't actually want to take a position. Not so. My grandfather drew upon at the time we were the Parshas HaShavua talked about Yaakov meeting with Esav, Parshas Vayishlach, and the pasuk tells us Vayikach min ababa yado mincha leEsav, that Yaakov took from that which was in his hand to prepare as a gift for his brother Esav to appease him, and Rashi says min hababa yado, from the things that came from the things that were in his possessions. That Yaakov took to give as a gift to his brother things that were profane, things that were non-sacred, but things, as my grandfather said, that were min hakadshim, things that were the most important to Yaakov. Those things he did not give to Esav, and would never have given to Esav. And so my grandfather concluded. So that, my friends, Jacob's peace treaty is certainly a great lesson for our times. The peace treaty that Yaakov made with Esav was a lesson, was a signpost for how Americans should think about the prospect of making peace with the communists. Because at the time, of course, the trade-off was either we make peace and we get to stop fighting a war, that would be wonderful, but we would have to surrender, surrender to the communists certain political dissidents that would be who would certainly suffer, and that my grandfather thought was morally unconscionable. Or we could continue fighting, and we'd have more war, but at least we would retain our basic morality and our basic morality and our principles. At least that's how my grandfather understood the situation. So my grandfather said, if peace conflicts with truth, peace must go and truth must prevail. Such is the moral decision of Judaism, and it is a decision binding upon all descendants of Jacob. And therefore, if today the free world is faced by this conflict, Korean truce versus forced repatriation, peace versus truth and justice, it is the principle of truth and justice which must win. Now, I sometimes reflect, you know, my grandfather had a stronger command of the English language at 24 years old than I will ever have in my entire lifetime. So it's almost a stinging rebuke to read these words, if only for the rhetoric alone, if only for the aesthetics alone. But nevertheless, I think the important point remains, which is that what do we have an obligation to teach? Or perhaps, if you will, is there anything that about which we have no obligation to teach? Is there anything that religion shouldn't touch? Absolutely not. My grandfather thought that the values of the Torah and the values of Judaism should have something to say, not also to the most important issues of the day, or not even to the most important issues of the day, but especially to the most important issues of the day. And that brings me to the final point about my grandfather's sense of our Jewish obligation to teach. And that is how we should teach. I think we're all familiar with a phenomenon in our own day of Jewish thinkers or thinkers who claim the mantle of Judaism, pontificating about what it is that Judaism has an obligation to believe about various causes around us. And I think in our own day, if we're thinking about causes where I think people rightly believe that Judaism should absolutely have something to say, is the question of how to cope with racism. And certainly in my grandfather's day, my grandfather was a well-known rabbi at the height of the civil rights era. This was an issue that my grandfather addressed on many, many occasions. My grandfather was an extremely outspoken supporter of Martin Luther King Jr. and the fight for civil rights. But what I think distinguished my grandfather from many other rabbis at the time who laudably took that same position was that my grandfather not only believed that Judaism, my grandfather first of all believed that to the extent that Judaism has something to say about civil rights, and we absolutely do, in fact, the things we have to say about civil rights are, we believe, the most important things that can be said about them. First of all, if we have something to the extent that we have something to say about them, we should be able to express those things in our own indigenous language using our own indigenous concepts. And by abandoning those concepts, we are simply adopting the language of other people, whether they be activists or whether they be other communities of faith. By adopting the language of others, we're simply allowing Judaism and Jewish thinkers and Torah thinkers to be used as props in somebody else's battle. And that, even if it may be convenient and comfortable, is a betrayal of what we believe to be our duty to teach, number one. And number two, my grandfather believed, to the extent that Judaism has something important to say about an issue as fundamental to the human condition as the fight against racism, we have an obligation not only to use our own terms and our own language, but to actually explore them and show how Yahadus has something unique to say about those things. And that brings me to a remarkable drasha, a truly remarkable drasha, that my grandfather gave on August 31st, 1963, the Shabbos after the March on Washington, after Reverend King's March on Washington. On that Shabbos, my grandfather cited the Gemara in Bava Basra, Peches Amad Beis, where Reb Levi says that Kasha Onshin Shel Midos Yoser Me'Onshin Shel Arayos, that the sin of maintaining in your possession false weights and measures is worse than the sin of Arayos, than the sin of immorality. Now, how could that possibly be? My grandfather cited the Netziv, who says that all Averos in Judaism, all transgressions within Jewish thought, can be subdivided into three categories. There are crimes of passion, there are crimes of hatred, and then there are crimes that bespeak a lack of faith in God himself. And the paradigm, or the worst cases, the most extreme cases of all three of those categories are the Gimel Chamuros, are the three cardinal sins for which a Jew must lay down his or her life rather than transgress. So the worst expression of a crime of passion is Arayos. The worst expression, the most extreme expression of a crime of hatred is Shvichus Damim, is murder. And finally, the worst expression of a crime that bespeaks lack of faith in the Creator is Avodah Zarah, is idolatry. And of those three, says the Netziv, the third, idolatry, is the worst. So my grandfather reasoned, therefore, that the reason why false weights, maintaining false weights and measures, is a worse crime than arayos is because maintaining false weights and measures is not a crime of passion, and it's not a crime of hatred. It is a crime that bespeaks lack of faith in God. And more importantly, said my grandfather, Avodah Zarah is actually, idolatry is actually different in not just in degree, but in kind from the other two types of crimes. Because idolatry, as like other crimes that bespeak a lack of faith in God, it's you can technically transgress them as an individual. It's possible to be Oved Avodah Zarah as a single person. But typically in the real world, in nature, the only time that we ever really encounter idolatry is in a communal context. It's very hard to be a lone pagan. A pagan, you can imagine pagan communities. There are societies that are sick and that are wayward and that allow for a lack of faith to occur. And false weights and measures was one such crime that was similar to idolatry, my grandfather thought, because to be able to have false weights and measures in your possession, to so cavalierly trick not just one customer, but dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of customers, the only way in which that could be possible is if you live in a society that in some way either sanctions or insufficiently discourages some activity. You have to live in a fundamentally sick society. And for that reason, my grandfather believed racism, especially the kind of racism that took place and was present in America during the civil rights, or on the eve of the civil rights era, was quite similar to the avera of midos, of maintaining false weights and measures, and ultimately was a form of idolatry. My grandfather, over the course of many drushos, developed this idea very deeply of racism as idolatry. And in fact, every single time my grandfather ever spoke about racism, he always referred to it formally as being within the category of avodah zarah. As my grandfather wrote, the methodical economic exploitation of one segment of our population, the systematic oppression of one race as the source of cheap labor and its designation as the first to suffer in any economic recession, when the economy of a great nation is built upon such patent injustice, it is a crime of Avodah Zarah, it is a breach of faith. Now this is important, not only because of how my grandfather felt about racism, which is important in and of itself, of course, but because you'll notice that my grandfather, when he spoke about this particular problem, he did not use the language that was common in the civil rights era today. He wasn't using academically in vogue concepts from the society around him. He analyzed the problem and commented on it privately and publicly, using the indigenous language of the Torah. And his commentary was all the more powerful for that. So that, I think, brings us to the end. And then I'll conclude just by noting a third element of my grandfather's understanding of how we should engage with the world. We've already seen his emphasis on the importance of our willingness to listen. If we're going to impact the world around us, we need to be able to hear what the world around us is thinking and saying, and in fact, learn from it. At the same time, and in fact, more importantly, and maybe even as part of our willingness to listen, we have an obligation to teach. We have an obligation to teach the world what we think because we are holy revolutionaries. We have an obligation to comment on all manners of importance in our society, and we have an obligation to do it using our indigenous values and ideas and the native terms of our wisdom. And third, we have to do it with a sense of dignity and self-respect. And what I mean by this is the following. There is a tendency, I think, for people in the Jewish community who are very passionate about, who are admirably passionate about Jews and Jewish thinkers weighing in on the hot button issues of the day. There is a sense, or there is an eagerness, I think often, especially amongst younger folks, for the Jewish people to ally themselves with anybody who feels similarly about these issues as we do, even if those people don't like us, and even if those people in fact hate us. And my grandfather found this very difficult to stomach. The first point that my grandfather made about this, in the truth is, in the interest of time, I'll skip over this source, but in essence, My grandfather felt very strongly that when Jews enter into these debates, we do so not as allies to some other cause. I think that's a popular term in the contemporary parlance. We should be allies. My grandfather thought that Jews should not be allies with anybody. We should be Jews, and we should do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu thinks is right at all times and in all places. But my grandfather believed that when it comes to potential people who are who share common cause with us, if we don't stand up for ourselves against even friends who disparage us, then nobody will. And my grandfather brought this to life in what I think is one of, if not my favorite sermon that my grandfather ever gave, and we'll conclude with this. And that is a sermon that he gave the week after the Kent State shootings. This was in 1970. The sermon is called Confessions of a Confused Rabbi. It's the only drasha of my grandfather, so far as I know, that isn't actually a drasha at all. It's just a methodological expression of how he goes about compiling drushas and preparing drushas. It's worth reading for that reason alone. As I said, it's the only methodological drasha that my grandfather ever gave. The drasha begins where he notes that the previous Shabbos, when the Shabbos after the Kent State shootings had occurred, that my grandfather decided not to speak about them. And some people in his communities, especially young people, came up to him and said, "Rabbi, how could you not talk about the Kent State shootings?" My grandfather writes, I think very charmingly, "In a sense, I admit that this particular form of criticism was welcome, since it offset the sometimes disgruntled reactions that come from my occasional foray into public issues." In any event, my grandfather explained why he didn't talk about the Kent State issue, the Kent State shootings. And he gives a variety of reasons, all of which are worth reading. But one that I want to focus on, which bears on our issue, is that although he felt that he had potentially a perspective on the Kent State shootings, he was wary of making common cause with the kind of student activists who were angry about it. Because, as my grandfather said, many of the campus activists in the 60s and 70s who were very passionate about some of the very things that my grandfather himself was passionate about, were also often extremely anti-Israel and sometimes even anti-Semitic. And as my grandfather wrote, "I question the priorities and consistency of many Jewish students when they make of the Black Panthers, who were Black nationalists at the time, a great cause celebre of their moralistic movement. Yes, I agree that they are in this country entitled to a fair trial and to be protected from police brutality and vindictiveness. I believe we should see to it that the police who were brutal are punished, and that even Black Panthers receive their rights as American citizens. But they are not our friends. They are anti-Semites and they are anti-Israel. I would like to see young Jews who seek justice for the Black Panthers and more power to them in their passion for justice oppose these pernicious anti-Semites with equal zeal." And I think there are parallels to this even Bizman Hazeh, that when we enter into the public arena, we must first do so with a willingness to listen. We must then do so with a sense of our obligation to teach the world around us. And third, we must do so with Jewish self-dignity and respect. We have to understand that when we do this, we can't just make common cause with anybody who wants it, because if the people who want to make common cause with us are directing their hatred at us, it's not up to somebody else to call it out, it's up to us. And I think to draw to a close, therefore, I'd like to, you know, we began this talk with the reference to a space mission that occurred at the outset, or sort of at the outset of my grandfather's prime. I'd like to close by reference to a second space mission, one that took place at the very end of my grandfather's prime as a public speaker and thinker. And that is the space mission, the ultimately ill-fated and doomed space mission on which Ilan Ramon was one of the astronauts. For those of you who don't remember, Ilan Ramon was an Israeli astronaut, one of, if not the first Israeli astronauts into orbit, who was killed upon reentry into the atmosphere. Ilan Ramon was notable because he was very publicly Jewish. He was chiloni. He was not a dati. But he took up with him into the space shuttle the Torah of Bergen-Belsen. He took up a Sefer Torah with him. He kept kosher, and he very publicly kept kosher. And when he died, my grandfather held a memorial service at Yeshiva University, at which he said the following: like Moses, who went up to receive the Torah and bring it down to the people of Israel, so too Ilan Ramon went up bringing the Torah of Moses to display to his people on earth. And I think it's so fitting to consider the journey that my grandfather took and that American society and American Judaism took from the beginning of his prime to the end. At the beginning of his prime, my grandfather had glimpsed the barest possibility of the Torah and Jewish thought and Jewish life influencing the world around us. But crucially, in 1968, it wasn't Jews who were doing the influencing. It was others. We merely saw the tantalizing possibility of what would happen if we did it. By the time his prime concluded in 2003, it was Jews who were taking it upon themselves to influence the wider world for the good, even from the heights of the heavens in the stratosphere itself. And I think, as I reflect upon my grandfather's extraordinary life and his contributions to the world of Torah, he was not able to finish his journey, to finish his life as an Eved Hashem the way that he wanted. By the end of his, the reason I say that his prime was over and around in the early 2000s, even though he only passed away in 2020, is because as he got older, for reasons that are hard to understand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took away from him so many of the things that made him who he was. His ability to speak, his ability to teach, and eventually, even really his ability to learn, or to actively learn. And my grandfather should have had many, many years after 2003 to lead the way, to show us by example how to take advantage of the incredible opportunities that we have as a Jewish people in this world, in a world where we can broadcast our values from the heavens themselves, from the heavens themselves. And he wasn't able to. And it's one of the great tragedies, not of his life, but of our lives, that he wasn't able to do that. But my only comfort, and our only comfort, I think, is that he left behind Talmidim, and he left behind a community. He left us behind with his teachings, armed with his wisdom, and buoyed by his Torah, so that as we venture into a world that will certainly be beset with challenges, but will just as much be full of possibility and opportunities for spiritual advancement, for Jewish teaching, he left us the ability, he left us a blueprint for how to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim Barabim in the days, months, years, and decades to come. We do it by a willingness to listen to those around us, just as he was willing to listen to everybody in Amsterdam Shas or Zaltzbach Shas. We do it by remembering our obligation to teach, because that is who we are and who we've always been as a people. We teach, no matter what the issue, using our own language, and we do so as proud, dignified, self-confident Jews. And if we do that, then we truly can call ourselves his students and his Talmidim. With that, I conclude. I know the hour is late. Everyone is, I suppose, is dismissed. I don't know what the protocol here is from the Beth Abraham staff. I'm happy to take questions if people are interested, but I know the hour is late, so I'm assuming everyone is dismissed. And I leave it now to my my superiors in the Beth Abraham hierarchy to direct traffic. Rabbi Neuberger, close this off?
All right, thank you so much. As I mentioned this afternoon, that you brought both the intimacy of a grandson and the intimacy of a Talmud and the scholarship of your training. And we thank you very, very much. Thank you very much.
Laila Tov, everyone.